Welcome back to the Strong Style Podcast. You are here with your hosts, Lydia Mackay and Sophie Lane. We have Sophie Lane, who is an EP, a running coach, and an S&C performance specialist for runners. And myself, I'm just your everyday running physio extraordinaire.
You got to sell yourself a bit. You're not average, that's for sure. Thank you for the intro. This is an interesting one for us because we are here in person, right next to each other. We couldn't be closer if we tried. We are almost touching knees, which we normally do this on Zoom. So this is quite nice.
It's quite
in
nice.
A weird kind of way. I feel like I can't look at you because we were like, we're a bit
we're
too close.
We got distracted.
But hopefully the audio quality is good.
Stare
into my eyes. I think hopefully the audio is good. We're doing it for you guys.
We're doing it for the audio. It's so funny because so many people have asked us when we both now live in Sydney, like, oh, that must be so nice recording the audio in person together. I'm like, as if.
This is it, actually. First
this
Sydney
is the first one.
Audio. I don't know the last time we did one, but it was pre this era of our lives.
Oh, yeah. A long time ago. Mm. But no, typically we don't make the trek into each other's lands.
Into each other's hearts.
Oh, no. Well, it's a long way over the bridge.
It is.
As
big
us
bridge.
Eastern suburbs. You know, I said something in my soul episode. I don't know if you've listened to it yet, but I was
does
like,
does anyone listen to my sons?
And I was like, the knee.
Oh, yeah, that was weird. You had a glitch.
No, it was me.
No, I know, but like you, like as a human, glitched.
Yeah, I glitch a lot.
Yeah, I don't know. But you kept doing it. Like, you're like, oh, I just, oh, knee. Like, I don't know, those extras. There was too many. But yeah, none of that today. We are on professional duties.
Yes, we're so professional. And it is so exciting because there's a blue sky. The sun is out. We've had a few days of cloud. And now it is all systems go. The sun is shining. And you know what else?
What?
Autumn is not that bad.
Neither is winter, which is what we're in now.
Oh.
Autumn, on reflection, the last 3 months that we had
was
fantastic.
Oh, I take it back. Yeah, okay.
The current season is also pretty good too.
You know, I had to ask a patient the other day what year we were in.
Oh, gosh.
Anyway, I'm not good with the dates or the times, but I am good with rehabbing running injuries.
Yeah, you are. Link below. We should put that link below.
Yeah, we should put that link. Put the booking link in, please, producer.
Okay. Anyway, why are we being silly? Let's cut to the chase.
Liz, cut to the chase.
Give us your fortnightly update. You've got some notes today, which is very professional. We normally just go for it, but Lydia is on the ball with the notes. I'm expecting no dawdling, no off topic, very concise.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so here we go. Straight from the notes, I prepared myself quite early today and I'm ready to tell you. So, you know, I'm always whinging about my injuries and all my niggles, and I feel like overall I'm in the best place I've been. Although it's not exactly like that because I'm still not completely pain-free. So I feel like the last week and a half, I was almost going to say that my hamstring's been so quiet and I almost haven't noticed it at all. But I think just over the weekend, it just popped up just a teeny tiny bit again. And that's okay. I think that's just going to be a little bit of a part of it, like when I run a little bit further or like a few more hills. It's likely to pop up, and I think that's okay. Mm. I was at like 26 Ks of my long run, and it was so nice cruising along, and I stopped at a water bubbler because I'm trying to get better at stopping and having water. Previous Lydia would never do this, but I was like, I'm going to stop. This is like the seventh bubbler I stopped at on my run, which
nice.
I know, look at me going well. Yep. But of course, like the bubble's quite low and like the hinging position is like such a stretch for the hamstring. And I just really put my head in there for that water. Like I got my head in.
Like a squat.
Well, I just didn't think. And I just had this sort of like sudden ouch moment of my hamstring.
Wow.
And then I had like another couple of Ks and it kind of was just a bit achy. And then I walked home with like a couple hundred meters to go. Oh, actually, no, that's not true. That's right. I didn't walk home. I was like, that's it. Once I hit 27 Ks, I'm going to just start walking, just walk the last K home. And then, of course, I got to 27 Ks and I was like, once I hit 28 Ks, and then I got to 28 Ks and I was like a couple hundred meters from home. So I basically ran all the way. But in my head, it's so funny. I thought I walked home, but I didn't. I just ran all the way home. When it started hurting, I was like, I'm just going to walk the rest of the way. And I just ran another 3 or 4 Ks. But overall, it's still feeling really good. the last 2 weeks, I haven't done any strength stuff. I mean, that's not true. Any speed stuff.
That's right. You really changed your tune. Strength is out. Cancel it.
No, I've been hitting the gym as always. But no speed stuff because I just really want to rest my perineal, which is the new one that's popped up. I can't remember if that popped up in the previous episode.
I think there was something about it. Yeah.
Briefly. Yeah. So it's just popped up a little bit. And I think...
We really undersell these things, hey? Like, your perineal sore, right?
I have a perineal tendinopathy is what I have.
Which you've had ongoing for a while.
I've had, like, it pop up a few times over the years. And I think last time was when I was in New Zealand at the end of last year and I, like, spiked my volume a little bit. And now it's just come up and I think it's possibly just because I increased a little bit more speed work. So I've just backed off on the speed stuff and... I think it's definitely settled a little bit. But you know what else I did, which really flared it up? Over the weekend, I went camping and I went diving and I had fins on. And the cold water, like cold is not good for tendons. And fins, oh my goodness, not good. So it was just like heaps of work and just the cold. That combination was terrible. Like when I got out of the water each day, I could hardly walk. And I honestly, like I didn't want to be too dramatic. But in my head, I was like, shit, like... I don't even know, like, I shouldn't be running at all. Like, I'm going to need to have, like, day off. Like, 2 days off, maybe even 3 days. Like, I'll have to have, no, I do have days off. I'm like, I'm going to have like, a good 3 days off because this is really sore. Like, I can hardly walk. I'm going to have to really drop down my volume. But then the thing is, like, they get warm and then they feel so much better. So I'm like, it's actually not that dramatic. But anyway, basically, I had 2 days off this week to, like, really let things settle because my... hammy was like a little bit tender after the long run and then my perineal felt completely pain-free at the start during the run. Even a few hours later, it felt fine. But then the next day, of course, as I always say, wait 24 hours after, it did feel a little bit sore, like really small, like 1 or 2 out of 10. So like not bad, but I just, in my head and my heart, I thought I should have 2 days resting. So I had full 2 days recovery. Anyway, so that's the perineal. This was a fun thing that I did on the weekend, a little activity. So I've always thought it'd be so nice to like do a bakery run where you like, have you ever seen that when people like go for a run and they like get their chocky milk and then they run home and they're like, just a quick trip to the bakery.
To the bakery for a chocky milk?
Or like, I don't know what you get the bakery.
So straight. What, do you not get a baked good?
Oh yeah, baked good, something like
that. Like a chocky... just the combination of the two things. I feel like chocolate milk's a great post-run snack. I don't know if you'd have it, you would have it mid-run.
Well, I...
I feel like, who have you got this story from? Where's the inspiration for the chocolate milk mid-run at the bakery?
I might have gotten...
I think you've mixed up a few stories here. But did you run to the bakery for a chocolate milk?
I might have gotten it a bit muddled.
I think so.
So this is my Sunday activity.
Okay.
So I went for a run and halfway through the run.
Right. You had a chocky milk.
No, I stopped at a little cafe in Surrey Hills.
Yeah.
And I got a cookie.
Okay. Great.
And it was so good.
Good. Okay.
Gosh, getting quite emotional
now. Yeah, look, I'm pleased about that.
So basically, the purpose is gels are overpriced, okay? I have a reason behind this.
Are cookies from the bakery not?
No, but the thing is, you pay like $7 for a gel or whatever it costs. I don't know, $4, $5, $7. And the whole like fueling while you're running, it's not my specialty. I'm trying to get better at it. But I was like, I don't want to carry a pack. I don't want to buy expensive gels that... you know, wasting my money. They don't taste that great. Like, they taste fine. I've always enjoyed them. But why not go to a cafe in Surrey Hills, which is a little bit of a pain to get to. I'm not going to just drive there ordinarily. But I'm going to run there. And I'm going to run 16 Ks there. It wasn't that. It was like 12 Ks. I don't know. And I'm going to get a nice, tasty choc chip cookie on my run and get those carb stores filled and then run back.
Yeah.
So that was what I did on Sunday.
Great. I feel like it sounds like a revolution to you. But I feel like it's just a thing. But I also have a counter.
What did I try and say? It's a thing.
Yeah, but not the way you described it initially. I have a counter argument.
Oh.
I think you just need to get over wearing your pack because have water pack where you don't need to hinge over and hurt your hamstring. It was just, you don't have to bend. It's just right there, ready to go. You can put Tailwind in it, which we've got a discount code for, so it's not expensive.
You're right.
Right? Pop that in. Hydration sorted.
What if I want to taste all the different choc chip cookies from all the different cafes in Sydney City?
It's going to be a big run.
I'm trying to live out my city life.
Go on then.
I'm trying to make the most of living the big
buy
smoke.
Those $7 cookies when you can't afford $7 gels.
Yeah, it was $7.
From like, so I don't know. Yeah. I feel like your points. Look, I'm glad you enjoyed the cafe. I feel like that's probably the only real positive here.
Yeah. It just felt like a little journey, you know?
Mm.
Anyway.
I'm Are so, you finished your notes yet?
Yes, I'm finished my notes.
I don't think the notes was a good idea. We're 10 minutes in now. I think the notes... And they encouraged the chat.
I dive with a shark, guys. That's my highlight of the year.
Oh, that's pretty cool.
I dived with a shark. Yes? Do you want me to say it one more time?
With a shark.
I was swimming along. I saw a shadow down in the depths and I dived down to it and it was a shark.
You sure it wasn't just a shadow?
There was four sharks.
You sure it wasn't at the bottom. Seaweed?
There were four sharks.
Wow.
Yes.
Wow.
Yes. Thank you. If anyone's got any questions, comments, send them in and I'll tell you. Do a whole podcast episode on the sharks.
You know what? Someone asked me to... add in the show notes the time stamp for when the interview starts.
Okay, all right, moving on. Sophie Lane, tell me about your week.
Oh, where do I begin? Guys, Global Running Day today. Lydia didn't even mention it.
Oh.
It is Global Running Day today, which is the best day of the year. Runner's Christmas, as I'm calling it. I feel like that's the new thing. So,
what if you don't like Christmas?
Well, this is, then now you will. Like, this is, you know, better.
Okay.
Anyway, don't ruin my moment. Runner's Easter. Is that
Runner's
Halloween?
Runner's Day.
Runner's Hanukkah. Why is that one funny? You gotta be careful what you say.
Don't even know Hanukkah.
Okay,
we'll do some research. Hawaii holiday.
Beer or Hawaii? What's the beer holiday and the Hawaii holiday?
Hanukkah, the beer.
Oh, Heineken? Wait. You're telling me you don't know what Hanukkah is in terms of...
It's like a holiday. A beer holiday.
Well, it might be also a beer. Hawaii? Where does that come from? Honolulu? You didn't think Hanukkah was Honolulu. Anyway, none of this matters. But Hanukkah is a holiday for a particular type of subgroup of the population, which we're not going to go into because we're not... You know, guys, we might... know a thing or two about running and
as it turns
injuries.
Out that's the only thing
we don't know anything about anything else. The world, politics, geography,
no.
Numbers. None of it. General phrases. Anyway.
Nothing.
So Global Running Day, guys. The runner's Hanukkah.
Hanukkah? No, Hanukkah.
No.
Honolulu. We're going to Hawaii.
Oh, best day ever. We both ran this morning with Lululemon and our own individual shops. Lydia was at Bondi. I was at Chatswood. And I led the Chatswood run around Chatswood. How many times can I say Chatswood? As many times as we just said Hanukkah. So much fun. Thank you. Shout out to Andrea and Andy and Kara and Mick for helping out on the day. And everyone else. Beck and Gavin for the Tailwind supplies. Belinda for the cookies. A whole bunch of people helped out.
Here's you with your bloody cookies. I bet they were $7.
Free?
Ah, oh, of course. Yes. Local businesses.
Yeah.
So you do like cookies on your run?
Well, in fact, I missed out. I didn't get one.
Oh.
I know. All that hard work. Nothing.
Terrible.
Also, it was post-run. Doesn't matter. Anyway.
Intro? Because we still haven't finished our run yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've stopped my watch. Oh, I've hit save. Okay. I did not hit resume later. But yeah, we're going again tonight, guys, because Global Run Day, we're going to do a double. My hand's so uncomfortable right now. I can't get comfy, guys. Lydia's taking up the space.
I'm just gonna
come right up here.
I asked if you wanted two cushions.
Well, it's not the cushion. It's the like proximity to you right now that's making me uncomfortable.
This is why we stay in our bubbles. This is why I didn't go to chats with this morning.
Anyway, so much fun. My updates are just had a physiotherapy initial consult with a physio in Clovelly, not to be named. We did some great assessments. She's right here. You guys know who she is. We did some assessments. My left hamstring is weak as what's something that's weak?
It was very weak.
Like a twig.
Like a leaf. Little leaf blowing in the breeze.
Yeah, like a soggy leaf. Autumnal. Or winter. Anyway, weak. Need to do some strength.
It's gone.
Need to change my stride to increase my cadence, as probably most people feel like that's just the go-to, isn't it? But our cadence was a bit low.
Yeah, I was also Sophie's over cadence is quite low, and particularly on her left side, that's big old stride. Over stride.
Massive.
So different compared to her right.
Mm. So yeah, we've got a few bits of homework to work through, but feeling positive, feeling like we've got some good answers, and yeah, just going to continue to keep my runs short, flat, high cadence, short strides.
Mm, we're going to listen to the metronome when we start our runs this evening. A bit faster.
See, I don't know. I'm the 160 kind of girl.
Yeah, we got to work on that.
We do. And then, yes, strength stuff, continue that and progress that as planned. And
we are adjusting your strength. We're going to try and bias the medial hamstring.
Oh, that was interesting.
I'm going to bias the semitendinosus and the semimembranosus.
We are.
Instead of the good old bicep fem.
Yep, get those double semis going.
And we're also doing some more ankle and toe mobs.
Mm, yes, shout out to Tom DeCanto.
Yes.
For a bit of help with the old foot. So that's me, I reckon.
Any highlights?
Look at the clock, 15 minutes.
Any highlights of your
30%.
Week?
30%. Yeah, Global Running Day.
Anything else?
It's only Wednesday.
Oh, but the last whole week and a half. Stressed,
I can't think.
What about your rock climbing?
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a great time last weekend rock climbing with you.
Nice.
And then we're going to Fury's Run Club tonight for Global Run Day Part 2. So that's going to be fun. 6K in the city.
Yeah, we've never gone to Fury's before.
No. And then post-run beverages.
Yeah.
So we post-run Heineken's. And Lydia doesn't start till 10:30 tomorrow, so we're going wild on the Heineken's.
But as I'm sure you're aware, if I don't start till 10:30, can you imagine all the activities I've booked in prior to 10:30? We've got a lot going on.
Yeah, well, anyway.
But yeah, might be a big Wednesday evening.
It might. Hope you're all well. Thanks for listening. We've got a really, really good episode for you again once
as
again.
Always.
But this one I think is really cool because we have Jono Riddler, who is an ultra marathon swimmer. He's recently completed New Zealand's longest swim ever in open water. What a title. 33 hours he was in the water and it was just shy of 100 kilometers. Now, I struggle to imagine how this is possible because having your head in the water for like an hour, 2 hours a day, crazy. 33 hours, like just to be constantly in the water through the darkness of the night, all conditions.
Yeah.
I just can't imagine.
Yeah. It's crazy. I mean, it's so funny actually. It was really sweet. At the start of this episode, you said something like, you introduced him and then you're like, and Lydia, she just did her first 10K. And I just like, I felt so like awkward and embarrassed as if like my 10K was comparable to his 100Ks. But it was really sweet that you consider me as like,
yeah,
well, Lydia. Like, and Lydia swims 10Ks.
Yeah. Anyway. I just wanted to feel like we related. And I just feel like my 1K didn't really mean much.
Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. That's fair. I guess what I was going to say is, because I've swum 10Ks.
Expert. Swimming extraordinaire.
I feel like I have a teeny, teeny, teeny understanding, the smallest
understanding. I don't know what word that was for a second.
Smallest understanding of what it's like to be submerged for a while.
And let submerged.
Yeah, submerged.
Wow, yeah.
Let me tell you, it's a long bloody time.
Mm.
Like 3 hours in the water is a long time. And like everything gets wrinkly. I think for me, I get cold is like such a big thing. But it's just so long to just be, like all you can do is look down and you don't really see anything like bubbles and like sounds. And anyway, it's just insane. Like what it does to your, I asked him about his skin as well. That was interesting. But just the whole thing, there's just so many parts of it. Like the salt in your throat, that was a whole big thing for him as well. Oh, it's full on. So just absolutely blown away by the fact that someone could swim so far. So yeah, we were very excited to have him on. We asked him a little bit about how he got into swimming, if he's had a fear of the water ever, and he actually has a little bit of a story around how he used to be quite fearful of the water. We spoke about some cold water training and some winter swimming tips, which might be helpful as we are in winter now, as we turns out. And then he spoke to us about some of his training, which absolutely blew me away, like hearing what he did. I think there's an Instagram post that he did and he was talking about what he did over like Easter weekend. And it was like something stupid. He's in the pool the whole day, 8 hours. And then he did the same thing the next day. And he also has a full-time job and a partner. And does he have children? I'm not sure. But just insane. He also came back from a shoulder injury as well. And then he's just obviously, as you can imagine, got a very gritty headset And it was very impressive. And we feel very inspired. And I think Soph's
I'm on board.
Entering a swim, I'm sure, the 10K in Balmoral, something like that. Anyway, this isn't our usual episode is basically what we wanted to say. We normally interview runners, but I think generally the whole mindset that goes into doing any sort of ultra endurance event is incredible. And although it's swimming and it's not running, I think there's a lot of parallels. And I also think probably a lot of runners have dabbled in a little bit of swimming. I know a lot of runners don't enjoy swimming, but I think there's a lot to learn, a lot to take away from Jono's absolutely incredible ultra marathon swim. So really excited to hear your thoughts and your takeaways. And we know that you're going to be excited and keen to take on a new challenge, whether it's a swim or whether it's an ultra run, or maybe it's just getting to your first 5K park run. Whatever it is, wherever you're at, I'm sure you're going to take some value and we can't wait to hear what you think.
Yeah, could not have said it better. Thanks, Lids. And thank you all for listening. Check out our link below for some Tailwind Nutrition so you don't end up like Lydia with a sore hamstring and a mid-run cookie. Be more prepared than that. And also Vivo Barefoots if you're in the market for some new shoes. Thanks so much for listening. Thank you for your support. Like, subscribe, follow, all those good things. And we'll talk to you.
Okay, welcome back to the Stronger Stride podcast. Today we are joined by Jono Riddler, who is an ultra marathon swimmer and has just completed New Zealand's longest open water swim ever. He was in the water for around 33 hours and swam just shy of 100 kilometers. Welcome, Jono.
Thanks, guys. Really good to be here.
Yeah, we're so excited to have you. I think obviously we've spent a lot of time with ultra runners and done a few ultra runs ourselves, and Lydia's done a 10K swim, and we're kind of really intrigued by the whole mindset behind what goes into events like this, and just being head down in the water for such a long duration is something really hard to imagine. So really keen to hear about how the event itself went. But before we get into it, do you want to just tell us a little bit about your background? Who are you? What do you do? How did you get into swimming? And I guess what sort of inspired this big swim that you've recently done?
Yeah, for sure. So I'm based in Auckland, New Zealand. My background as a swimmer is I didn't have too much of a background as a swimmer initially. So I did some learn to swim lessons when I was younger, probably for about four or so years. And that was really just enough to get the basics, the foundation of being able to swim and being somewhat competent in the ocean. So we spent a lot of time around the water growing up, around the ocean, you know, going to some of our local beaches around here and spending a lot of time on Great Barrier Island, which is where the recent swim started from as well. So always had a pretty close affinity to an association with the water, and especially the open water, but not so much in terms of the swimming side of things. Definitely haven't come from a competitive swimming background. And then when I was 21, I was in Canada, and it was a few days after my 21st birthday, and I was snowboarding, had a bad fall, injured my shoulder really badly. And then coming back to New Zealand after that, I went to the pool as a way of rehabbing my shoulder. And later that year, joined up in my first ocean swim event, which was about 3K across Auckland's harbour. And that was inspired in a way by my dad and brother who were doing that as well. And then things really just grew from that point.
Dramatically.
Yeah. I mean, it's been, for me at least, it feels like a natural progression, but going from 3K to 100K is a pretty steep lift. But that has been over the course of, you know, the last 12 years. So a little bit of stuff has happened in between what I've recently done and my first ocean swim event. So building up from 3K to, you know, 5K, and then eventually doing my first marathon swim, a 10K distance in 2016. And from there, really cranking it, up and getting involved with some of the longer ocean swims around New Zealand.
It's incredible, really, isn't it? Because I think in Australia, we like typically most people live on the coastline, and swimming something that is very much natural. And it sounds like you've, as you said, you've always been someone who's enjoyed being in the water. But I imagine what that looks like growing up in New Zealand is quite different in Australia, because it's just so much part of Australian culture. Like, the water's not that cold, like the weather is a lot warmer. It's just so easy and natural to be in the ocean. I think even people that aren't swimmers would probably I'm just going to guess that we'd probably just naturally swim a little bit better than what you guys would growing up in New Zealand. So was there ever periods of your life where you were scared of the ocean or intimidated by being out in the open water? Is that something you've had to work on, or is that something that is not been as much of a challenge, more just like actually the swimming part, like extending into that swimming part?
A little bit. Like, I think for me and looking back, like, that definitely has been dulled, that sensation of being afraid of being in the very deep open waters. But initially, like going back to that 3K swim that I did across Auckland's harbour, I had a somewhat of a panic attack when that swim started. It was a deep water start, and you know, just that sense of really being separated from land for maybe only 30 minutes or so, but out in the middle of the ocean and yeah, fully detached and no immediate way to escape. Of course, there were lifeguards and the like that I could actually lean on, but that fear was definitely there. And I think before that, you know, again, we spent a lot of time in the ocean, you know, getting pounded by waves, playing around and that kind of thing. So I think that helped with my eventual entry into open water swimming. But now it's like I love being out just in the middle of nowhere where you can't see land and you're just kind of floating.
That's terrifying. It's insane. Do you think that panic attack was also something that enticed you, like the fact that it seemed like such a challenge potentially in that moment, and then like did that draw you in further? Because I mean, there's plenty of people who have like a lot of fear around the ocean and they have these particular moments and then that's it, they're like, oh, you know, they're quite cautious after that. But it sounds like maybe that drove you further, or maybe it was just one particular bad day, I don't know.
No, it's an insightful question, because it did, the sensation of having that fear and then stepping through it and making it to the other side really increased the levels of elation that I felt on the other end. So I think that while it was, you know, hard to work through it, it was helpful in the long run and really hooked me.
Mm. And have you had any more sort of moments like that? Was that kind of, I guess, as bad as it got, or as you sort of progressed with your swimming, have you had other moments like that? Obviously you would have had some tough moments, I imagine, but any more of that kind of panicky state and I guess really stressed out feeling?
Yeah, not so much with being out in the open ocean, but some different kind of encounters. So, you know, swimming at night, that's something that I've had to work through in the ocean, because obviously there's the potential for marine life encounters, and then also having actual marine life encounters and seeing sharks and the like in the open water. And that that's same kind of panic sensation that I might have first had on that ocean swim way back in 2011.
Wow. Oh, it just makes me so excited. Like, I'm just smiling hearing all of this. Something that I want to hear all about this mindset stuff, but I'd like to hear a little bit more about some of the practical things just firstly, because I know that the water temperature is a little bit colder in New Zealand than it is in Australia. And I was in Queenstown end of last year, and it was like my mission to get in and try and swim in the water. And I got like 700 meters and that nearly killed me. I was just frozen to the core the rest of the day. And I was so proud of myself. I thought it was just the biggest effort ever. But tell me, what is the temperature of the water that you typically swim in? And how do you prepare for cold water swimming? Is it something that you've naturally been quite good at? I mean, I'm surely there's still a limit of natural ability, but yeah, what's the process like? What sort of temperatures are you dealing with and how do you prepare for that?
Well, so the normal temperatures in Auckland, they have been increasing over the last 5 or so years, the surface water temperatures, but they're generally like throughout the year, probably 12 degrees up to about 22 degrees. So 12 degrees in the middle of winter, in August, which is the coldest point, and then 22 degrees in at the peak of summer, which is normally around February. So when I undertook this swim, this recent swim from Great Barrier Island, it was at or just below 19 degrees for the duration. So I've done a lot of cold water swimming over the last 5 or so years. Like in the build up to Cook Strait, which I undertook in 2019, I spent my first winter swimming non-wetsuit, and you know, that was kind of the start of my cold water swimming journey, getting getting really used to what it felt like to swim without a wetsuit, because that's one of the rules, without a wetsuit in the cold water. And it was tough at first. Like I was definitely hypothermic on a regular basis, but that was all helping with that building of the cold adaptation and actually changing my body to be able to deal with those conditions. And over time, I've just built and built on that to the point that I'm actually quite comfortable now in, you know, what most people would consider quite cold water. Swimming Fovo Strait, that was around 14 degrees at the start, 15 for most of it. I've done ice swims in less than 5 degrees Celsius water. You know, I set my ice bath to about 1 degree. So like I'm pretty used to now sitting in and being comfortable with being in cold water for long durations.
And before you going into that water, are you doing any like breath work, visualization? Like, is there a process before you get into that rather than sort of jumping out of the hot, warm car and just jumping straight in? I'm imagining there's a bit of a kind of taper process to get your body ready for that and your mind as well.
Initially, yes, but now, you know, it's kind of second nature in a way. So,
yeah, when so I was conditioned.
Yeah.
That's insane.
When I was doing these cold water swims through winter initially, I would kind of mentally prepare by playing a certain music track in the lead up to parking my car and getting into the ocean. And that really helped with getting into that frame of mind.
Can I have a copy of the music? I think I need it. I need to get through Australian winter. So I might take that if you don't mind.
And then, you know, there's a few kind of things that I do prior to getting in the water or when I'm getting into the water to help with that immediate acclimation. So things like when you're getting in and it's cold, I'm not jumping in the water and going straight into it. I'm kind of easing into it and going down to my neck depth and doing some breathing exercises there. And then when I feel comfortable, which is normally about 30 seconds to a minute of just sitting there, then I start going. And I find that that helps with, you know, the start of the swim at least, and not being overly, not so much panicked, because I think that panic sensation has really left, but not being uncomfortable when I'm starting. And then, you know, you make sure that on the back end of it, you've also got some things ready to help with the inevitable after drop, which is going to come when you get out of the water.
Yeah, so I mean, it sounds like there's obviously a huge physical adaptation that's happened for you, like over the years of building this cold tolerance, but there's also a big mental part. What do you think that ratio is? Do you think dealing with the cold, I mean, surely the body adapts, but is it also just getting so comfortable with the uncomfortable? I mean, I guess that's a common theme in any sort of endurance sport, but with the cold particularly, do you just learn to get used to, you know, shivering, or should you get to a point where the body is just so adapted and you're just actually not as bothered anymore?
Yeah, I it's really hard to put some kind of a ratio on it. It's like 100% physical and 100% mental.
Yeah, okay.
But yeah, I think I've traditionally tended to push it further than a lot of people would, but that has worked for me. And you know, like you say, when you get to the point of shivering, do you stop there or do you keep going? And I've tended to keep going, and I'm pretty in tune with my body by now, and I understand when, you know, too much is too much, I think. Definitely pushing things so I can actually get those adaptations, because I think it's in that kind of sweet spot where you do. And if you know that, you know, shivering isn't actually the end of the world, you're mildly hypothermic at that stage, and you've got a few other levels to get to before you're actually in any kind of real danger, then, you know, it's good to understand that and the science behind it. So I've done a lot of research and into hypothermia and understanding, you know, what are the dangers before I really push myself, and using myself as a bit of an experiment for that as well.
As long as you've got the ambulance on speed dial, right? Like, just have them there ready to go, right? That's fine.
Yeah.
Goodness. And tell us about your actual training sort of regime, because surely it takes a huge volume of training to build up to swim as far as you did just over the last weekend. I saw one of your posts on Instagram back in April over the Easter weekend, just talking about your casual weekend, and it was something crazy like 8 hours of swimming on the Saturday and the Sunday, and starting at, I don't know, it was like 1 or 2 a.m. something stupidly early. And I love getting up early, but I don't think I've set my alarm before 3 a.m. or 2 a.m. before. That's crazy. How is that what your normal weekends were looking like leading up to this? Was that like the big weekend of training? How do you fit it all in? And is that the standard for you?
Yeah, the training journey for me started back in August of last year. Mm-hmm. So I built together this beautiful kind of training arc where I started at, I don't know, it probably was about 35 or 40K per week. So looking at my weekly mileage and building that up to a peak of 100K and holding that for 3 weeks, yeah, and then tapering off. So I was well on the way with that, at about 75K per week by the end of November. And then I got injured. So I was injured across December and January. And then I had to change up my training plan in a big way and kind of entered into a second phase. And that second phase involved a couple of strength and conditioning workouts each week, a couple of pull workouts, and normally two long swims, either in the pool or ocean, preferably the ocean, and then the pool if the weather was not suitable. So as you say, that culminated in, it was 3 8-hour swims back to back on Friday, Saturday, Sunday over Easter weekend, and then a 4-hour swim on the Monday. That was 2 8-hour pool sessions. So 8 hours in the pool on Friday, 8 hours in the pool on Saturday, 6 hours sleep, and then waking up at 1 a.m. to get into the ocean at 2 a.m. on Sunday. Wow. So it was a lot of swimming. I found that the back to back ocean swims, or, you know, pool swims where I needed to as a backup, were really useful in terms of the physical side. So understanding what it was like to train fatigue, but also the mental side. You know, it's not that easy getting up at 1 a.m., 2 a.m. in the morning to go out to the ocean when it's dark and cold and swimming on your own. But I think that was really beneficial and definitely helped when it came to the attempt.
There's also about, because I mean, obviously there's logistical issues or like the struggle of just generally fitting in that volume of training. Because I mean, I know plenty of people that run 70 to 100 Ks a week, which when you look at the hours that seems like a decent amount of running. I mean, I'm sorry to keep comparing it to running, but I guess that's where my brain tends to go. You know, that's a lot of time just running, but these are numbers of swimming. So that is an astounding amount of time in the water. I mean, I know you swim pretty quick. Yeah, it's still longer than running time. So there's a lot of training to fit in. But I imagine as well, getting up early would also just be practice for swimming at different times of the day. Because I know that's what a lot of ultra runners will do too, is practice running or training at the times of day which they're going to be racing. And obviously for an event which is happening longer than 24 hours, you need to be comfortable at all the different hours of the day. Was that a big consideration or less important than just the volume of training?
The time of day was somewhat important. There were probably two drivers for swimming at night. One was that I didn't have anybody to put sunblock on me, so I was going during the night because I was doing these long swims on my own. So I was going on my own and not putting any sunblock on. So trying to swim at night to avoid the sun, but also dealing with what it was like to swim at night and getting used to that sensation of, you know, inevitably I would be swimming through a night, and just getting used to that sensation. And it's actually quite pleasant swimming at night. Like it's a good way of clocking up the Ks. I mean, going back to your question around how to balance it, it's difficult. Like on my peak week, I did about 32 hours just of swimming, and then there's everything around that, like recovery and all the rest of it. So, you know, up to 40 hours or so of everything, and the planning and the media and everything. So yeah, it was a tricky balance, but I think, you know, you kind of find time. And my wife Sarah was a big help as well with picking up some of that slack.
I'm sure she's glad to have a mention there. And are you working on top of this as well?
Yeah, that's right. Working, you know, a normal week would be probably 45, 50 hours as well.
Yeah. This is incredible. Like, I mean, so the biggest barrier I feel for most of us training is time. It's like, oh, I can't fit it in. Like, the amount of time I've heard people say, oh, I work 9 to 5. How am I meant to fit in training outside of that? So I feel like, yeah, that's absolutely incredible and huge. And were you fitting in your S&C stuff as well during those peak weeks, or was that a bit more dialed back and really just focusing on being in the water?
Yeah, still doing that. Still doing the strength and conditioning stuff. And can't remember whether I was doing ice baths around then or not as well, because I started ramping that up. I think that would have been mostly after my training build was completed and I was entering into the taper where I really started cranking up the ice bath. So yes, still making sure that I was doing the gym work and what I needed to do, because I was still rehabbing my shoulder at that stage. So that didn't disappear, and that was still evident until the start line of the swim. You know, it was something that I carried through, but it was manageable.
Mm. Was it that an overuse injury, or what was the injury?
I think so. I don't know exactly what it was. It was originally diagnosed as bursitis, but I think it was actually a nerve issue originating in my neck. Potentially, I was working through it with the physio, and they were finding it pretty difficult to pin down, but managed to rehab, and that definitely helped to bring the pain levels down and get it to a point where I was able to take on the swim attempt.
Mm. And during those long training swims as well, are you taking on nutrition through these? Are you breaking them up into different sets, or is it just an all out effort? Like, how did each kind of session look, or just in general, did you have different focuses for each swim session?
The longer ones were really just aerobic and getting in the time. And yes, I was taking in nutrition during those longer swim sessions. Mm-hmm. So because I was doing it on my own, I'd make up my feeds when I woke up in the early hours of the morning, all liquid feeds, maybe a couple of bananas and some gels, but you know, things that were relatively easy to take down and to arrange. And I'd have a toe float when I was swimming, which is like a little inflatable buoy, which you strap around your waist, and it tails behind you, and it had the capacity for one bottle, which I could put in there. Mm-hmm. So I'd have one bottle. I'd swim up and down the beach. Every 40 minutes I'd have about half of a bottle, so you know, around 300 mils of fluids. And then when I got to the end of a bottle, I'd go walk back up to my car, which was just on the boat ramp, swap it out with another bottle, the empty bottle, with a full bottle, and get back in the water. Mm-hmm. So that whole process would take maybe, I don't know, a minute or two.
Yeah. I mean, it's such a disruption. Like, I think that's just a huge, well, I mean, there's obviously lots of differences, and I shouldn't keep comparing this to running, but here I am doing it again. Like with the, you know, fueling for endurance, it's really the only, at least that I can think of, endurance sport where the fueling means that you literally have to stop what you're doing. Because obviously, you know, on a running, hiking, on a bike, like all those activities, you can be sipping while you're still running or walking or whatever it is. But swimming, you know, like you have to take a breath, hold a breath, take a breath, hold a breath. You physically cannot. So every time you're having nutrition, you're just floating, right? Or is there some way that you go into backstroke and do like a little back kick? Like, does that happen? Or do you literally just sort of like bop about, put something in your mouth, and then maybe, yeah, I don't know. Tell me, how does that actually work?
Like the racing marathon swimmers, the elites, and you know, people that are actually looking to do this for speed and time, they do what you say, where they're past, you know, their drink, they immediately go into a backstroke, a one-arm backstroke. They take their feed down, and then they're on their way again. So it's a very quick process. For me, it was more treading water for that period of time. So I can't touch the boat when I'm doing these swims, and I'm just taking down these liquid feeds out of a bottle that's tossed to me on a rope off the support boat, and treading water for, you know, 30 seconds or so, and then on my way again.
Wow. Yeah, I mean, it's just so incredible. I guess, as you said, you could really refine that and make it super speedy and fast. But I guess when you're dealing with such an enormous distance, that's probably not the priority, is it?
No, exactly. I'm not exactly going for speed. Like I dropped my pace by about a K per hour. And so, you know, when I'm racing, I'll be, depending on the distance, you know, swimming at over 4K an hour. For the duration of the swim, it was 3K per hour, holding that for basically the entire swim. So very much staying in that aerobic, those aerobic kind of levels, and not worry about time at all, just getting to the end.
Yeah. And can we talk a little bit about how the day actually went, or the day and a half went, how the big swim unfolded, I guess, maybe the last few days leading up to it? What was your kind of last bit of preparation for that? And then how did it go, I guess, from start to finish? We'd be keen to hear some of the details of the actual long swim that you did.
Yeah. So the lead up, kind of a bit interesting in itself and a little bit different to running in some ways, because if you have a running event, you know exactly when it's going to be. You turn up, you can taper perfectly for it, and the chances are that you'll be able to do it on the day, right? With these longer swimming efforts, how it works is you tend to set a window around a tide, and in this case the neap tide, and what that meant is that the tidal flows would be weaker. So the water, as we had looked at it, was likely to be washing in and out of the harbor, and so we would be facing the tide sometimes, with the tide at other times. It would largely be neutral, but I didn't want to be swimming against a strong spring tide, which could, you know, the tidal flow could more or less match my swimming speed, which means that I'm going nowhere. So we picked it around the neap, and that started the 25th of April and went until May the 5th. That, you know, we bumped it out a couple of days either side, just to make it a little bit longer and reduce some of the risk about around poor wind. Mm-hmm. So coming into that window, I'm starting to look at the wind forecasts and really trying to see if we can pick down some kind of a date to start on. And it's quite difficult over, you know, doing one of these multi-day kind of swims, because you need to really get good wind across 2 days ideally. And we've just had a horrible summer over here. It's been terrible weather, and we've had tropical storms throughout the whole of summer and even into autumn. So, you know, that was the case as we were entering into the start of this weather window. We just had really strong winds from both the east and north, primarily. And so, you know, I'm checking the wind forecast probably a dozen times a day. It's not getting any better. I'm going half mad.
It's so stressful, because like obviously you've had such a huge build up. You've come back from injury. There's just like so many parts to it, and there's just nothing you can do to change the weather except like continually refresh, continually check it. Like that'd just be so anxiety inducing. That'd be really, really hard.
Yeah. You just can't do anything about it. Total lack of control. You know, during the training you can do everything that you can to prepare, and it's totally in your control, and you know that's awesome, even though it's hard. But then you really, you know, and we'd put this out there, so we'd really put the swim out there. Like we had media, we had billboards at this stage. Like it was kind of next level. But then we just needed the weather to play ball, the wind to play ball. And I was hopeful. You know, I kind of had the sense that it was meant to happen, and so I held on to that. But coming into the weather window, or the tide window, that there wasn't any immediate options, and so I kept on watching. And then on the Friday before the swim started, so the swim eventually started on the Tuesday, on the Friday I was looking at it, and you know, probably the best opportunity was going to be starting on the Tuesday. The wind was less than 10 knots for most of Tuesday, but then picking up from about midnight on Wednesday morning and getting worse as the day went on. So it wasn't ideal. You know, it definitely wasn't the 2-day window that we were looking for, but it was kind of as good as we were going to get. And so fast forward to a couple of days after that, on the Sunday, I'm on the massage table getting a massage. I get a call from the co-skippers of the boat, the main support boat, and we talk through it. They say, you know, how comfortable are you with it? I'm reasonably comfortable with it, and just thinking that really there's not going to be any other opportunity. So, you know, we went out on a limb and activated the crew from that point and went ahead. So we knew it was going to be bad on the Wednesday, good on the Tuesday, but that was, you know, that was the best opportunity that we could take. And yeah, we went around activating the crew. We had 16 people out on the water, so it's a big crew.
Wow.
And they all had to, you know, get their lives sorted out for the next few days. We left Great Barrier Island on the Monday in the morning, and it was still blowing 20 knots and had three meter swells coming into us when we were traveling out. So what should have been like a 3-hour boat ride was about a 5-hour boat ride. And most of the crew got sick along the way.
Oh gosh.
Because it was quite gnarly.
Wow. Do you take seasickness tablets? Because that's something that I've read about is like a huge part of marathon swimming, is like just making it to the start line without, you know, vomiting or being seasick. Is that something that you take? Like, is that what you do, or it doesn't bother you as much?
Yeah.
So definitely. A little laugh there.
The swimmers and the crew, definitely. We all took down seasick tablets. And for most of the journey across, I was just lying on a couch in the boat and hoping that I wouldn't, you know, spill my guts.
Oh gosh. Wow. So you were quite sick as well then?
Yeah, I was pretty queasy, but luckily we had the night. We didn't start straight away when we got over there. We had the night to, you know, find our legs again and
clean up the vomit, you know, prepare.
So, I mean, a little bit concerned, but I've been on boats enough in my life, and I mean, it hasn't really helped me with my seasickness, but we got to the other side. And then had an amazing night at this place called Karaka Bay. Lovely little cabins that are right next to the water. Great Barrier is a really special and kind of spiritual place. It's just like an amazing little island off Auckland's east coast. It's not even that little, really. It's just but yeah, it's a magnificent place. And we stayed there the night, and then in the morning, you know, it's the wind had completely settled off, beautiful morning, and started getting going about the preparations needed for the swim ahead. So making up the feeds, some of the feeds for the first shift. I had brekkie, obviously, and then when eventually the time came, we were going to start at 10 a.m. Walked on down to the ramp, the boat ramp where we were starting from, and got lathered up with some nappy rash cream for sun protection, and then petroleum jelly and lanolin for chafing. And with that, the swim was away.
Gosh, that's cool. I think, were you, obviously with the conditions coming over, were you nervous about that? I know you said that the wind settled. Were you knowing that was going to be the case, or were you getting a little bit nervous with the rough seas on the way out?
Yeah, I mean, we definitely got a sense of what the open ocean was really like, and you know, I've spent a lot of time swimming out in the open, but like that was rough, and seeing it from the vantage point of, you know, this is how far we're traveling, this is how far I'm going to swim back, and probably what are likely to be similar conditions. I tried to ignore that as much as I could.
Nice.
And just like a few of those practical things. So the nappy rash cream is for sun protection. I didn't know that was a thing. What about zinc? Like, does the nappy rash cream stay on longer? How does that work?
It's the stuff called pseudocream, which has a portion of zinc oxide in it. So it's 15% zinc oxide.
Wow. And then it just stays on your skin.
Yeah, it stays pretty well, unless there's areas that rub, like under my armpits or you know, the areas like that. But yeah, I still had it in the on me in the hospital the night after.
Wow.
Amazing. That's cool. Yeah. And then the petroleum jelly is the best thing for chafing. None of the fancy like anti-chafe lotions or sticks, that's the best one.
No, the petroleum jelly and lanolin mixes are pretty well used and known mix in swimming circles. Normally I just get away with using petroleum jelly. And you know, that for most people that's Vaseline, which is the branded version of that. And that tends to work really well. But the lanolin just helps with those longer durations, because you know the petroleum jelly can rub off after a period of time. So use that mix, and yeah, that seemed to work pretty well.
And then does that also protect your skin? Because I guess that's the other thing that I'm quite curious about, is your skin health. Like I spend so much time in the ocean and my skin is dry all the time, and I like experiment with putting like lotions on my skin beforehand, like moisturizers. I have used petroleum jelly, not for chafing, but just like to try and protect my skin. I feel like obviously like just that time that you're in the water, I guess as a once off is one thing, but the thing is it's like every week for you, there's like all that volume of training. So how do you not end up just like a scaly lizard, or is that just who you are now?
Yeah, I didn't really do too much to intentionally combat that.
Didn't overly get
a sense that my skin was drying up or anything like that. It definitely did when I was spending time in the chlorine, like swimming in chlorinated pools is nasty, and you know, I got stuff like chlorine cough and super dry skin, and my eyebrows were falling out and all the rest of it like that. That was not much fun, but being out in the ocean, I didn't so much get the sense of that. Like you say, you're like, you dry out a little bit with the salt, and you notice that afterwards, but no, it's not like I was putting barrier cream on or anything like that. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess the chlorine is definitely the worst of all of it. I mean, at least, yeah, it sounds like it. And in my experience as well, the chlorine is just awful.
Yeah. It's nasty stuff.
Yeah, that's gross. So tell us now, like, you know, that was the start of the swim, obviously so much that sort of just trying to get to the start line would have been huge. Did you find that pretty quickly you relaxed into it and you sort of just got into your rhythm, or was it a combination of up and down and being in the zone, out of the zone? What was that like?
Yeah, the initial part of the swim was really beautiful. Like we were swimming out of Karaka Bay up into what's known as the Colville Channel, which is between, you know, Barrier and Great Barrier, Little Barrier, around that area. And yeah, it was initially it was amazing. The water was almost dead flat because it was sheltered, and just seeing the rolling hills of Karaka Bay on either side was really picturesque. And that probably lasted for about probably four or five K or so until we then entered the open ocean outside of the kind of safety of the land and were properly exposed. It wasn't like it was really rough at that point. I think the swell had eased off to maybe meter and a half, and a little bit of chop because of the wind, but definitely not anything nasty. So I got into a really good rhythm from the start all the way up to Little Barrier, which was about probably 20 to 25K. That first 20 to 25K were really nice, and just getting into the zone, as you say. So that it would have taken, I think I did my first 10K in 2 hours 40 and then eased off into a more stable pace from there. So it would have been about 6 hours or so to get to the tip of the Little Barrier. And then started having, at that point, unfortunately, a little bit of gut distress shortly after reaching there around dusk on that first day. And that was a bit niggly to deal with.
Was that due to a nutrition error, do you think? Or is that something that is just, you know, duration? Because obviously there's, I imagine, a length of time and intensity that at some point eventually something is going to happen with the gut. What did you think that was related to?
I think inevitably it was related to my nutrition in some way. I did take an anti-inflammatory pill around that time, and I think the combination of those two things impacted on my gut. So we changed it up. One of the core parts of my feeding plan was dropped, and that was a decision that was made by the crew. I basically said to the crew, like, I'm having this problem with my gut. It's not so good. Can you guys figure it out? And there definitely wasn't any any high levels of frustration. I was more probably worried at that stage, yeah. That because if I was having that, then was that going to continue for the rest of the swim? So we managed to work through that, fortunately, and it did eventually die off. I can't remember exactly how long it took, but it would have taken a good part of the night for my gut to settle off and get back to something of an even keel.
And just on that, with the crew, who did you have with you on the boat? Did you kind of have a select group of family and friends? Were there people who had kind of been experienced in this ultramarathon swimming world that kind of knew what you would have needed, what sort of advice to give you throughout, encouragement, and how to deal with these problems that might arise? Or was it just people close to you?
So we had 16 people out on the water, as I said before, and that was made up of a mix of people that I had handpicked that were marathon swimmers, experienced in their own right and had gone through maybe not something quite to this extent, but similar kind of ultra marathon swims in the past. So I think I pulled in about six or seven of those people, and then some of the crew was brought in by Live Ocean, which was the charity that I had partnered with. Live Ocean has a strong connection to the sailing community because it was founded by two America's Cup sailors. So that was really good. Getting some experienced boaties on board. And we had a couple of medics, couple of videographers as well. So the way in which the crew was structured, we allowed for multiple people per different role. So on the little support craft that sat alongside me, a 4-meter inflatable tender, there was always a driver, an observer, and a feeder, and there were three shifts of that, and they would do that every shift would be 3 hours, so they just rotated like that. And then there were two skippers for the main support craft, which was a 56-foot launch, and if you weren't on the little inflatable alongside me, you would be on the main support craft, and they'd just cycle out, bring in another inflatable, a little inflatable alongside the 4-meter inflatable. When it was time to switch out, they'd do the switch, and I'd just keep swimming during that time. Mm-hmm. So it was quite seamless that there wasn't any impact to the swim.
Yeah, awesome. I think it sounds like, obviously there would have been so much organization and logistical planning, but it sounds like you had a good team and obviously a few backups in case they were needed, and gave people some time to rest in between while you're still swimming the whole time, which is a pretty funny concept. If you want to continue on, I guess what happened from that point?
So I guess the next major event would have been nightfall on day one. So starting at 10 a.m. and nightfall would have been about around 6:30 or so, and Little Barrier, while it's called Little Barrier, isn't actually such a small island, so we had to swim around that for the night. And when I say swim around, go across the northern point and then down the western side before we hooked down and started bearing towards the final destination. So that night when we were swimming, that was a really pleasant time. It was one of my potential concerns coming into it because I hadn't done a lot of that day-night-day type swimming before. Mm-hmm. And I wasn't sure whether, the sleep deprivation would get to me or not. I took in a couple of no-dos just before that and had some gels with caffeine as well. But it was fine. I didn't get tired at all and, really got into the rhythm of things, just swimming next to the support boat alongside me, and couldn't really see anything. There was some phosphorescence in the water, which was quite beautiful. Oh. So it was lighting up as I was swimming, and the support boat next to me had these red LED strips on the side. So it was outside of that, it was like sensory deprivation. It was just me and the water.
what are you thinking about while you're in there? Obviously you can't chat to people until you kind of stop and have a drink. It's just you and your head and the darkness. Like, do you have kind of a script in your head, things to think about? Have you got thoughts that you want to be kind of going through as you go? Or is it literally just you're so focused on just swimming that you're really zoned in on that?
Yeah, it's hard to look back and think about what I was thinking about. I know that there were a few things that did come through my mind, but for the most part, I was trying to keep my mind as hollow as possible and just not thinking about anything actively. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is really because your thoughts can distract you and potentially take you down a negative path. So wanting to kind of keep my monkey mind in a box, in a sense. So I did a lot of counting, just counting one and two into time with my stroke. Mm-hmm. I know I did a lot of that.
When you say counting, are you just like one, two? Like, do you count every breath? Sorry, I know that sounds so silly, but are you counting, I don't know how many, do you breathe every second stroke or every third? I don't know what that looks like, but is it just until every time you breathe, or are you just counting up until you're like 2,372? Like, what number do you get to?
I think I got as high as about 10 during the course of that time. Most of the time it's just one and two. So like you say, one, two to time with my breath.
Yeah.
Gotcha. And then back into it, or left, right, or something like that. And, you know, singing the one, two, buckle my shoe song as a way of kind of timing that. But my head was, I don't know, it was pretty empty for the most part. When I did get into those negative spaces, I came back to the counting, which helped, or coming back to why as well. You know, the why of the swim and why I wanted to complete it.
Yeah, it sounds like you probably, well, I'm imagining you do some meditation practice alongside your swimming. I mean, I guess swimming, at least in my experience, I find it quite meditative because I feel like, I mean, I frequently count my strokes and I find it just so relaxing and quite cathartic. And I find that the time just disappears when I'm really focused on just being present with the strokes. But as soon as I let my mind wander, it all of a sudden, like, it gets hard. And then I start thinking about, oh, how long have I been? Like, how long is there to go? Or like, is this sore? Like, oh, I'm bored. Like, I just want to get out and do something else. Like, I'm getting cold. But when I'm just thinking about the strokes, one, two, one, two, it's challenging to stay focused on those strokes, but it gets easier the more I practice it. And I will be honest, I definitely haven't been that great at practicing it in the last couple of months. I've just let my mind go all over, and it totally changes the swim. Do you have a practice outside of swimming to enhance that, or is it really just in the water you practice getting into that headspace?
I've been a practitioner of meditation for years and years now, but
makes sense.
Yeah. In the lead up to the swim, I wasn't doing a hell of a lot of meditating. The training, in a sense, was its own kind of meditation. And I'd often get to the, you know, I normally do my meditation as a way of bookending the day. And I did try to do some meditation at the back end of the day and just ended up falling asleep during it.
Fair enough. I think that is so fair.
Yeah. So, you know, the meditation practice dropped off a little bit during the training, but I think that's definitely helpful, being aware of your thoughts and being able to utilize some of those tools that mindfulness meditation gives you to be able to pull your mind back and be aware of your thoughts when they do get into that, particularly so the negative space. I didn't actually mind my mind going off on you know, doing its own thing and just running around for a little while, as long as it wasn't negative. So I let it do that. But as soon as it got negative, then, you know, you need to be able to pull it back.
Do you feel like that's an extra edge or an advantage, being able to, I guess, having that meditation background and even just awareness in your swimming? Because, you know, I guess the idea is that meditation is something that you can then use in the rest of your life. But I don't know how often that actually is the case, because I guess everyone has slightly different practices. And, you know, you often hear people talk about exercise. They're like, oh, it's my meditation. Like, going for a run is my meditation. But I think it's often just such a throwaway thing. And I think people don't always know what that actually means. And I, you know, obviously each to their own, everyone can do what makes them feel good. So it's not about me saying that that's wrong or bad. But I imagine that having the practice of actually being so aware of where your thoughts are going would just be such an advantage and probably something that everyone should do. Is that how you view it? Or do you think that it's actually more common than it isn't in that sort of endurance space to have that focus on the brain?
I think the kind of people that succeed or that are drawn to ultra endurance type sports are probably of a similar leaning, where they already have that capability. Their minds aren't bouncing around at 1,000 miles an hour as it is. So I think that it draws those people in. And then the people that are more successful tend to be able to click into those flow states a little bit easier. It's very transferable as well. You know, like the obviously meditation has been beneficial in terms of my swimming, but also in terms of other parts of my life as well. And work, you know, in stressful situations, being able to objectively see when I'm getting a little bit stressed, or you know, getting frustrated or getting angry or whatever it may be, and being able to pull yourself out of it. So I think they definitely go hand in hand, and there's some transferable skills across, you know, meditation, swimming, and what you might call day-to-day life.
Yeah, just having that self-awareness I think is so important. And it's amazing when you can, yeah, have those skills and practice those skills in the swimming. And as you say, it carries over to daily life. I think there's so many correlations between, you know, these really big endurance efforts where you're going through quite a roller coaster of emotions. There's lots of challenges, and it does sort of, I guess, mirror just general life as well, just general stress and challenges in life. And you mentioned as well, thinking about your why during this time, when things got hard, you were probably really focusing on the reason that you're out there, the purpose for it. Do you want to dive into a little bit about how this actually came about and why you're actually doing it and what you were kind of raising awareness for?
Definitely. So I've done over the years quite a few swimming challenges for my own benefit, wanting to understand a little bit more about my own physical and mental limitations and capabilities. But I really wanted to, when I was cooking up the idea for this swim and when we were starting to pull it together, I wanted to do it for something that was meaningful to me, to use the swim as a platform to drive attention towards that meaningful cause. And, you know, I've spent a lot of time swimming out in the ocean and particularly so in the Hauraki Gulf, which is, for anybody that lives over in Australia, it's the just off the east coast of Auckland, big body of water that stretches out beyond Great Barrier Island out here. And I've seen, even over the short period of time that I've been alive, my short 33 years, I've seen a change in the environment and the health of the marine ecosystem. You know, I've had some amazing experiences being able to swim with dolphins and next to workups and with manta rays and stingrays and all kinds of beautiful things, but that is decreasing, at least in my experience. And I'm seeing an increase in things like sedimentation, so the water is quite dirty. What happens when we have storm type events is the sewage system can't deal with it, and so it runs off into the ocean. So the water is very dirty and cloudy, and you know, we're overfishing, and that's both commercially and recreationally, and that has an impact on the wider ecosystem as well. And then you've got things like kinna barrens, where kinna, which are sea urchins, mowing down kelp because they're natural predators like crayfish, which are now functionally extinct, and snapper are not there in the numbers that they need to be able to keep them in check. And so that has an impact on the wider ecosystem and a cascading effect. So these are things that I've seen during the course of the years that I've been swimming, and earlier as well, being, you know, alive and spending a lot of time around the ocean. And I've seen the comparison of what a healthy ocean looks like, being able to swim in places like Fofo Strait at the bottom of the country. And so I was really motivated to do what I could to raise my voice for that. And that's how the partnership with Live Ocean really came about, which is a marine conservation charity. And as part of this swim, a big part of it, really, the big why was to get people more aware of what's happening out in the Hauraki, and hopefully off the back of this as well. Now that we're post close to swim completion is getting some action from our central government. So that's really what we're driving now.
That's incredible. And yeah, I mean, ocean health is something that I think should be more important to everyone. And, you know, there's so many people that love spending time in the ocean, or I probably could almost argue, surely everyone loves the ocean, whether it's like just from watching the ocean, swimming in it, surfing, sitting on the sand, just an ocean view. Like, I think it's something that's almost innate in us as humans to appreciate it, yet frequently not much action or not much thought around, you know, the fishing industry and where our waste goes. You know, there's so much to it, and obviously it's complex and it's not always that black and white. But what does this charity actually do, One Ocean Charity? How do they help to make an impact?
So Live Ocean, still a relatively new charity. They back, you know, the likes of scientists. They have their own projects and really driving awareness through things like sports, for example, and using platforms to increase the messaging. So really is about that advocacy piece. So where you might see with the likes of Greenpeace or something similar, you know, they're getting out there, they're doing protests and the like. It's quite a different approach with Live Ocean. So for anybody that's interested, probably the best place to look really is liveocean.com, and you'd be able to find out a little bit more about the work that they're doing there. It's it really is more focused in around New Zealand waters.
Yeah.
But a lot of the principles are pretty, you know, transferable across the world in terms of some of the things that we're seeing at the moment. The need for marine protection for one.
And is there anything that you think that an individual could do just in their own sort of day to day? I know there's obviously that Take Three for the Sea, which, I mean, I think that started on the Central Coast in Australia. I don't know whether you guys do that in New Zealand. Have you heard of Take Three for the Sea?
No. What's that?
It's literally just pick up three pieces of rubbish while you're at the ocean. It's just like an everyday sort of initiative. And I guess what my question to you is more about, like, are the things that we can do in our everyday life? Because I think it's nice to be, you know, writing letters to people in power and protesting and doing all those big things. I mean, obviously not everyone's going to swim 100Ks, but what would you encourage people to do in just the everyday life? Is it just talking about it? Is it collecting rubbish? Is it attending protests? What do you think?
I think for the average person,
yeah,
you know, being aware of what we say in New Zealand, kai moana, which is your seafood, where your seafood comes from. Is it sustainable? That would be the first thing I'd say to people. Second thing would be if this is something that you're interested in and you want to get some action behind, again, I'm kind of speaking to some of the local causes. So, you know, we're really trying to drive action for a quite specific cause that's domestic to New Zealand. And for those people and for people overseas, if you have a specific cause in mind, then really to get in touch with your local MP, because my view anyway is that for real change to be brought about, it's got to be driven by policy. Mm. People can pick up a few pieces of rubbish off the beach, and I'm not saying that it's a bad thing at all, but for real change, I think it does need to be driven by policy, and that it's got to be reasonably dramatic at this stage as well.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Yeah, it definitely is like a feel good thing, isn't it, to bring your keep cup and pick up some rubbish in the ocean. And I definitely something that I do. I totally agree. I think we need real action, right? Little things are awesome and they add up. Yet the world we live in, there's just too many people. There's got to be some more action. Would you be able to tell us now, like, how are you feeling? So it's a week and a half. Is it a week and a half, or it's not even quite a week after your swim? It's not a week yet, is it?
No, it's been about 2.5 weeks now, actually.
Oh, it's been 2.5 weeks. Oh, yes. Okay.
Yeah,
right,
so
well, there you go.
Finished on the Wednesday, I think it was the 4th of May.
Mm-hmm.
3rd of May.
3rd of May.
Yeah.
What's the celebration process? How's that been? And is there a sort of come down period? I imagine that it would be challenging finishing such a mammoth event and then sort of, you know, physically recovering, mentally recovering, you know, doing lots of interviews. I guess, as you said, like now the event's done, it's about sort of like promoting it and getting people to look up Live Ocean and getting involved. How's the come down being?
Yeah, I mean, you guys really know this, right? There is a bit of a come down.
Yeah.
I think I've gotten used to it over the last, you know, however many years of doing these kind of things. So I expect it, and it happens and comes and goes. And I think I probably most sharply felt that at the beginning of this week. And it wasn't that enjoyable, you know. you have this big high on doing whatever it is that you've set your sights on. And it's been a bit of a whirlwind, really. Like I talked about how we wanted to get attention for this swim, but it's just completely blew out of the water all our expectations. And the level of engagement has been massive, and like people reaching out wanting to chat, and all the media stuff and on the back end of that, that's been pretty continuous actually over the last 2.5 weeks. They're trying to manage that around, again, also still keeping my day job.
Yeah.
So hasn't actually been a lot of time to properly pause and reflect. We did a little bit of a crew celebration last week, which was nice, about 7 days ago, but we're still charging forward with a lot of stuff on the back end of this to keep the messaging going. You know, I think it's important to, we kind of built up a bit of a snowball, and you know, we don't want to see it just dissolve into nothing. We actually really want to do something with it. So the work of the swimmers is done, but the mahi, another Māori word, the work isn't really over. So we're still pushing forward. And I think for me that has actually helped with that come down in a way, because it's been lessened. There's a higher level purpose. It's not just you know, building up to this swim and then it's over. There's something else, something more meaningful that's keeping me going.
Yeah, it's probably nice for it to carry on and not just be purely just those 33 hours and then you can just go back to how your life was before. I guess having that kind of slow transition where you're still involved and talking about it and doing all those media activities and different things to do with it, I think that's probably a gentler way to get back to reality. So that's really cool. And how was your body like straight after the swim? How did you feel, I guess, physically and also mentally, just that next day or two?
Yeah, but rough. I mean, we didn't really talk about the second day of the swim, but that was, you know, that was a gnarly day. We had swell and wind coming up, and later that day, you know, I hadn't slept in a while, obviously quite sleep deprived, and started hallucinating and the like. So there were a few things that I carried through into the hospital when I eventually got there. So our plan was on the back end of the swim that there would be an ambulance there. Mm-hmm. The ambulance would, you know, just give me a check over and then release me, and I'd go back to my bed and sleep in my own bed for the night. There was enough of a concern, I guess, to want to send me to a hospital, really to get my electrolyte levels checked as much as anything. So I was sent off to a hospital in my togs, sand on my feet, in the back of the ambulance, and they checked my blood. I had high levels of CK, which probably ultra runners have experienced as well, which is, I think it's creatine kinase is how you pronounce that. And it's a marker that shows whether your muscles are breaking down or not. So my muscles were, and I was diagnosed with a mild case of rhabdomyolysis, which is when your muscles break down, they release a toxic protein into your blood. And so I was hooked up to IV pretty quickly and kept in the hospital overnight for surveillance. My body was generally just sore, you know, pretty achy. I had some particular spots that that had more pain than others. Like my, the pinky on my right hand was really bruised up, and my wrist on my right hand as well.
Wow. Is that just from like the impact of hitting the water with each stroke, or?
I was slightly bad technique. And, wow. And compounded over 50,000 strokes. So that was pretty sore, and I'm still dealing with that a little bit now. That's the only remnant, really. But the other interesting things that kind of happened, I got really puffy, just really swollen everywhere. So you know, my eyes puffed up all the way down to my toes. I couldn't feel my big toe on my right foot for about 4 days afterwards.
Oh, wow.
The glute on my, my glutes were really, really painful. I talked about how I had a massage a couple of days before the swim started, and I got worked a little bit too hard in my legs, and yeah, that wasn't so good. I went to stand up when I was in the hospital, and it was almost like 10 out of 10 pain.
Wow.
It was really bad. My legs were shaking for when I was swimming for probably the last 30K or so, because they were much pain. Yeah, no, it wasn't very good. What was some of the other interesting stuff? My tongue and throat. So I couldn't eat without pain for about 4 or 5 days afterwards. My tongue lost some chunks off it, and it kind of shed its top layer and regenerated that.
That's disgusting.
Did you notice the chunks? Like, did you swallow the chunks?
I noticed the absence of them. Yeah,
you could see them. Feel the divots
in a photo. Yeah.
Oh, is that just the salt literally eating you alive?
Yeah, it's just the impact of the salt washing around in my mouth for that period of time.
Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't very pleasant, especially the not being able to eat. Like I tried to have a sandwich in the hospital, and yeah, it was like sandpaper going down my throat. So I could eat yogurt pretty easily, but other things hurt.
Wow.
So yeah, a few kind of interesting physical things, and then the hallucinations that I was having on that second night of swimming that didn't stop entirely until after I left the hospital. Like I was still hallucinating a little bit.
Yeah, what were the hallucinations? Were they quite long lasting, or is it just momentary?
Oh, it wasn't. Yeah, that momentary. And the things that I saw. So I saw a snowman on the front of the support boat next to me. Solar panels and picture frames out on the water, and like tiles on the ocean below me.
Wow.
So that's when I was swimming. So the tiles, they stayed there for a long time, but the picture frames and solar panels came and went pretty quickly. And then the snowman made a few appearances.
Wow.
And then in the hospital, it was the wallpaper. It was just kind of like bubbling out at me.
Oh gosh.
Yeah.
Is that something you'd experienced before on previous swims?
No, never. I've never had hallucinations before. So it was interesting. And I wasn't sure really what was real or what wasn't at that stage. I asked the crew at one stage, I said, "Are you guys real?" Because I wasn't sure.
Wow.
Gosh, was that scary? Did you feel like worried that, you know, you felt you weren't quite, obviously weren't sure what was real and what wasn't? Was that terrifying, or were you just so out of it that it didn't really become fearful?
I was very much like just machine mode at that stage, but wanted to make sure that I wasn't completely unsafe.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Was there, I could talk to you all day, but was there a point at which your support crew would be pulling you out? Like, were there, obviously you had a medic on board. Was there going to be some kind of signal where they would know to take you out? You know, if you had said, "No, guys, like I need to get out," and they'd be like, "No, keep going." Like, was there some sort of like code word or anything where, you know, even if you were really kind of losing it, they would still keep you going unless there was, you know, X, Y, and Z? What was the standard for safety?
The decision to pull me or not was really with the crew. It wasn't like I was making that decision, and we put some pretty good governance around that. So once I started the swim, I was just swimming, and it wasn't my decision around what happened from that point. So one of the lead members of the crew, a good buddy of mine, he said to me beforehand, he said, "Jono, just tell me if something's going wrong." And I said, maybe. Like, I might tell you. But I did end up telling him. And so I used that intel and talked to the medic. And we had two medics on board, actually, which was really good. And, you know, they gave their thoughts. So when I started hallucinating, they said, no, that's okay, as long as, you know, XYZ doesn't happen. And so that was really good for that sounding board. So, you know, toward the end, the crew really had to flog me. It was only really called because of safety concerns. So the waves were whipping up in a big way, and the crew were concerned that the boat would come onto me, that it would be washed onto me. Because they had to stay close enough that they could react if if I did slip under, for example, but be far enough away that, you know, they weren't crashing into me. So it was a balance, and it became overly unsafe. Obviously, when you're doing these kind of things, that they're a bit on the extreme end anyway. But you know, there was enough of a concern there to make a safety call to pull in earlier than expected.
And I probably got to ask this before, but is the boat actually helping to guide the route, or were you navigating yourself?
No, I wasn't navigating at all. So we had set the course well ahead of time, and that was plotted out on the chart plotters on the boat. So both on the tender alongside me and the main support craft. And that was really trying to get the most direct route possible. So they navigated the whole way. I didn't really want to sight where I was going. I just wanted to stay looking at the support boat for as much of the duration as possible. The few times that I did look up and look where I was going, it was a bit detrimental. So, you know, it was better just to stay ignorant in a way of how far I had gone. I did say to the crew beforehand, you know, I don't want to know how far I've gone or how far I've got to go, how much time has gone or how much time I've got to go. Just try to stay out of it. But because I had planned quite a bit of it, I kind of had a sense of, you know, where I was and how I was tracking.
Yeah, wow. It's just incredible. I mean, there's so many parts to it. It's not as simple as just getting out there and going for a swim. There's just so many aspects to it, mentally, physically, logistically. Like, it's a huge feat that you've undertaken and absolutely smashed. It's so impressive. I mean, we could ask you questions for days, but I think we should probably wrap things up. We've been over an hour now, so you probably have better things to do with your afternoon. But thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate it. And it's just incredible and so inspiring. And I think the listeners, if they haven't done much swimming before, hopefully this inspires them to get in the water and give it a go.
Awesome. Thanks, guys. Thanks very much for your time. And look forward to hearing some more from you in future.
Yeah, thank you so much, Jono. Really feel very inspired and excited and, yeah, just amazed. And I'm going to jump on the Live Ocean website after this, and we'll leave it in the show notes so that our listeners can check it out as well. And obviously your Instagram and anything else that you mentioned, we'll pop those in the show notes. So thank you so, so, so much.
Awesome. Thanks, guys.